and welcome back to the M&A Zing, a weekly podcast for acquisition entrepreneurs, holdco builders, and search funders in the UK, Europe, and beyond. Sometimes you find in this space that there are people making a lot of noise, and then there are people that are just head down, getting on with the work, quietly building empires. And one such gentleman today joins me. He is a hugely successful serial acquirer who's built a group, three groups actually, of companies, five companies in total, engineering and fabrication companies based in the northwest of England and the West Midlands. So I'm delighted to introduce you all today to Jan-Marc Pican. Jan-Marc, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's an absolute pleasure and an honor. Thanks for giving up some time in your busy life. You seem to have a lot on, and I think as listeners and viewers will discover over the weeks ahead, even more on as time marches on. You're an unstoppable force.
Trying to. Despite of that, I need some sleep.
Oh, yes. Snoozing is losing, as they say. So you came to the UK. You have a successful corporate life behind you with Schneider Electric. Give us a bit of a whistle-stop tour of how you found your way here, please, Jan-Marc.
That was it's kind of a funny story because so I spent like over a decade in Schneider Electric in various countries. I worked for them in Germany, in Switzerland, and in France mainly, but with many other countries around the globe during that time. But how I ended up in the UK was that my wife and I actually started some business coaching. And then we went to an event in New York, and we met a guy called Phil, who's also one of the partners in this enterprise. And so that was January 2020. And I remember we were in New York. We had one guy there from Hong Kong, and everybody was joking around if he's going to make it back or if all the borders are going to be shut. And we all know what came after. So that was the last live event before that, and then we stayed in contact over COVID, and things started progressing. And then in 2022, things got pretty much going. And because I'm mainly dealing with all the operations in the group, I just couldn't go back and forth anymore. So then there was the decision made to basically relocate from Cyprus at that time to the sunny UK.
I'm not sure you traded up on the sun index there, Jan-Marc, but I can see the commute would be a lot shorter. So
the commute is definitely shorter. That's for sure. And my wife likes the weather here more than she does the heat. So.
Ah, okay. Well, to each their own. Exactly. My wife's the opposite, being of Greek descent. So, good. Well, so you've built these three groups through acquisition. This is the sort of tried and true, proper businesses that were from a generation of owners that had built them to a certain point. We have Phil to thank for patriating you to the UK to effectively oversee these and grow these operations. So Allied Global Engineering in Manchester as one group, GJ Engineering in Oldham as another group, and then Savica's Solutions in Birmingham as your sort of third platform. You've been very busy then in the last 4 years up to this point.
Allied is the group that sits across. And we have two machining businesses, which are essentially acting as one. That's why we refer to it as like the machining part of the business. And then we have GJ, which is the production fabrication part of it, and Savicas, which is more shop fitting fabrication. So they do like more high street stuff.
Great. So you have this unique background, which arguably bridges German precision and British grit, which I would argue makes you perfectly suited to this particular sector that you've chosen to build your empire in. How is that combination showing up in the style of leadership that you've brought to these businesses?
I'm How do I say that? I'm pretty direct, which I'm trying to adjust my tone to be more British sometimes. But as my leadership style is usually a very direct style. But I can fine tune it depending on who I'm talking to and what the situation is. A lot of the times when we acquire a business, there's a huge cultural change because things get done a certain way, and probably for good reasons, or because they have been always done that way for the last 10 years, 20 years, whatever it was. And then trying to change that depending on the time you have, you can be a bit more relaxed, or you have to be very decisive, which then is very very blunt sometimes. I'm very transparent in my leadership style, so everybody that works for me and that works with me usually always knows where I stand exactly. Because I share as much information as I can, unless I'm bound by confidentiality. But other than that, I'm sharing the good, the bad, and the ugly, in terms of customer feedback, in terms of what works and what not works. And one of the things I have managed to establish mostly, is that, don't hide anything. So as I we don't lie, we don't try to hide anything. If somebody makes a mistake, we'll
We
deal
own
with
it.
it, and we'll get on with it, because that's the only way how we can learn, how we can grow. And I think that's mainly my natural style. And then there are a
And
few adaptive ones.
have you found you've had to give permission for teams to behave that way, to be open and transparent and collaborative in that sense? Because I'm owner-operated businesses in the UK, I'm generalizing, but I've tended to find, in my experience, that there have been a bit of, unwillingness to embrace negative news that's kind of culturally, woven into the fabric of some of these businesses. And have you found that with the businesses you bought, that you've had to kind of re-engineer the culture to be more open and transparent?
And it comes out of fear. At least that's my feeling. To when you give people the permission to fail, they look at you like you're crazy. I think a lot of times, and it took me a while in my career to figure out that honesty actually propels you much further in your career, as if you're trying to hide things, especially if you climb up the chain. And it's like a few examples is, I got promotions that at that point I didn't want it because I wanted to get out, but I got them because I was like one of the few ones that was like just bluntly telling how it is. And a lot of people think you get punished for it, and to be fair, in a lot of companies you do. It's like if you are the bearer of bad news, you're usually the one that is like captivated.
Indeed. So
Unfortunately.
yeah, so creating that trust-based openness, that culture of sharing and owning both the good, the bad, and the ugly, as you say, has been quite transformational for the businesses. I'm pleased to hear. You mentioned in our previous conversations about how these businesses before you got hold of them were ultimately owner-led businesses. I think you've used the word chaotic in some cases, where perhaps you've had to bring order from chaos and create these scalable, future-ready companies that you describe them to now be. Walk us through what that looks like. I mean, in terms of what might be broken when you get there that you had to fix beyond the culture.
Is when you a lot of the time it's not only owner-led, but it doesn't matter. If a lot of teams, they have something which is called like tribal knowledge. So they rely on what that means. If you haven't heard the term before, is basically everybody knows how it's done, and because it's like it's delivered in stories and whatnot. And you ask John or whoever walks the floor, and how do we do that? And he would say, yeah, the last time we did that 15 years ago, and this is how we did it. This is how they service products. That's how they service clients. And it works. It works brilliantly until some of those pieces fall apart. Very often that's like retirement, sickness, unfortunately, or people just deciding to leave because they don't like it anymore, or they get a better opportunity or whatnot. And then a lot of the knowledge in companies gets lost because it's not
that institutional memory.
Yeah, exactly. There is no documentation, or very little documentation. Usually if they are ISO certified, which many are, there is the absolute minimum documented to pass the ISO, which is not bad. I'm not saying it's bad. It works. As long as everybody knows what it is. And then when you start changing things, this is then when you find out that where the gaps are. Because as soon as you change something, it has ripple effects. And if time permits, I usually go for like a kind of an iterative approach. So I change something and then I observe it for a bit to see what happens now. And then you identify the next bottleneck and basically you go like piece by piece.
And where have you found those bottlenecks to largely be in these businesses? I mean, on the shop floor or in the back end processes or, you know, in the back office? Like where are you typically having to solve those issues in these kinds of companies?
It's mostly a reliable system that works. It's also with suppliers that we deal with. It's like they're, especially this time of the year, you send them an email and they will say, it's like, yeah, my accounts department, AKA my one person that deals with the accounts, is on holiday and I can't deal with that for 2 weeks. So this is very, very often it's more in the back office than it is on the shop floor. Unless on the shop floor you have very specific operations or very specific parts where only one person is always doing it because they are the best at it. They've done it for a decade. You can wake them up at 3 a.m. at night and they can do it blindfolded. So nobody else gets trained because they are there. They do it. You make the most money if they do it and not somebody else. And then it's like, you have that thing. We have done that in some of the fabricated products that we make, is only like two people knew how to basically make it. And if they are not there, then your production comes to a grinding halt. So it's kind of both, but I see it more in the back office, just also because the headcount tends to be way lower. You have maybe 2-3 people in the office. In a typical company, maybe 4. So if you take one out, then it's already starting to get very shaky.
Yeah, I agree. I've seen that. Seen that firsthand. So, did you know this going in when you were looking to buy this kind of business, or is this something that you've learned to look for?
I would say I expected it, there is theory. And then there's practice. I mean, one thing I learned when I was studying, and I had this idealized picture of how work works, and then I started joining a company and I realized really fast that reality is not like what I learned. And it's the same here. It's, you expect it, but every company is different. They all run somehow on Excel. Even worse, it can be programmed macros from somebody that has like left the company like 3 years ago. And it's still just running on that version. There are all those different type of things, and you just have to be ready for it. And then think about where you want to go and where you, and if you know where you want to be, then you will find a way on how to get there piece by piece.
So armed with that expectation then, why specifically this sector? What was the attractive thing about going after, you know, established, mature British engineering SMBs?
For me, I just like engineering.
Because that's a good start.
I'm an engineer and I can't help myself. I like seeing parts being made. I like fixing stuff. I like taking parts, taking things apart.
No.
But it's for me, it's fascinating. And if you think about it, economy-wise, it's a really non-glamorous sector. I mean, nobody talks about the small engineering businesses that have 5 employees, 10 employees, even
No,
20 or
they're
30 employees.
massively
No,
undervalued in the UK.
it's like they are undervalued in terms of when it comes to the price you can buy them for, but they are also undervalued for the contribution they make, because
That's what I meant, actually. Yeah.
they can create some really qualified and good paying jobs, and secure jobs. And more than that, they secure a vital part of the supply chain, because a lot of the if everybody thinks about like big companies, like the household names, they assemble a lot of parts, but somebody has to make those parts.
Yeah.
And there's a lot going on in the sector about supply chain security, and also independence, especially when with how the world is going. It's like you don't want to have those very long, vulnerable supply chains anymore. You want to have alternatives.
Yeah, I think the
And
offshoring era of let's it doesn't matter where it is in the world that it's made, actually, as long as it's cheap. I think that mindset of 20 years ago has almost inverted now, and it is about supply chain security and nearshoring and being able to have greater control again. So these unsung heroes are absolutely essential parts of that transition. So were these companies, when you bought them, were they from retirement age owners? Are any of the owners still with the businesses, or did they all transition out?
There is one where Andrew from Savikas, he's still with us, but
Great.
that was the plan. One left for health reasons and the other one's for retirement. Usually the way you see it, the people near a certain age and then they realize, well, maybe I don't want to do that anymore. Deal with all the stress, because having a business is fun if times are good, and it's very stressful if times are not that good. And very often you go like up and down, up and down, up and down, and can be week by week, month by month, depending on customer crisis, whatever. And they all retired. Usually they don't stay on. And to be quite frank, when they it's probably better. It's good to have a handover and to have them available for specific things that only they know because of no documentation. But if you want to start changing things, there's a reason why they haven't done it. So it's like then
Well, to that end,
you start clashing.
transformation. We did you go into these looking to transform these businesses? Did you feel that they were transformation opportunities?
Yeah, that was the plan. Yeah, so it's like it wasn't they weren't businesses that you would buy and say it's like cruising. Because the way I see it, and the way you have to think about it is, if you buy it's kind of like buying a house. If you buy a house and rent it out, and you buy well, new builds, I mean, I've heard some stories, so maybe not, but let's say you buy a good quality house that is fixed up, properly done, everything up to standard, newly electric, plumbing, whatever, and you rent it out. There's not a lot of value left for you to create other than the tenant in it. But if you find yourself a house that is like the worst house in that neighborhood, then you get it a bit cheaper, but you have to accept the fact that you have to put in some work. And it's nothing different in companies. It's just the different mechanics, but you can create way more value if you find yourself a good base and then try to grow it from there.
Yeah, great analogy, yeah, Mark. And that it's often said that the best returns are secured on the deal that you do going in. You know, if you can actually buy a fixer-upper and you can put a bit of investment into the turnaround, actually exponentially you get more out than you put in. So I think there's gold there, definitely. And how has the transition or transformation been with these businesses? Has it been easy? Has it been difficult? Have you met resistance? And is the job done? Are you still on the journey of transformation with these companies?
We are definitely still on the journey. And it's an up and down. I find it's very difficult to hire the right people. And because in a smaller company, more than in a big company, every person in the business counts. Like, everybody has to do their job and has to do their job properly. And you can't afford to have that weight on the business, because it's exponentially more harmful than it is in a big company. No, we're nowhere near done. There have been times where it has rather been easy, I would say, where we got in a good flow and things started clicking. But then you have external or internal factors, and you go back and you have another transition. I mean, last year I did a whole management overhaul on the fabrication side, mm-hmm. Which basically means is like a lot of people left in the office, and we started rebuilding. And sometimes those are the tough decisions that come with it.
You have to cut the bushes in order for the new growth to break through, and that is just how it is. You end up with dead branches. So it's a difficult process to go through, but a necessary one. Change. So in previous conversations, you've mentioned that you feel that the engineering sector, in Europe, I guess also specifically in the UK here, is at a crossroads between tradition and transformation. What are you seeing specifically in that dichotomy?
A lot of companies are owned by people that either are very close to retirement age or are actually already classified as over retirement age. So they are like 68, mm-hmm. 70. One of the guys we bought Gene J from, he was 74 when he sold it. So you have that. They want to pass the business on. Very often they want to, but either their kids don't want the business, and sometimes it's also because they might have bad feelings towards it because it has taken their parents away. Because business is intense, and if you build it as an owner, you're not going to spend a lot of time at home. Or if you are at home, you're not really at home.
You're not present.
Yeah. You're not present, yeah. So there's that part. Then there are a few people are willing to take the risks, because you have to accept the fact that it can also go wrong doing your own thing and having your own business. Mm-hmm. And so there is a lot of the businesses that might just close because there is nobody to pass it on to. And it's depending on the owner, because that's how they created it. So they are the one in control. They want to be the one in control, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's just you have to accept the fact that you can't just hand it over because you are the only one that knows how to orchestrate that whole thing. So it's that. And then you have, especially in the last years, if I think back like 2 years ago, when I started with the CNC side of the business and the transformation, there was no AI in that sense. Like it's now there were early things. Yeah. And you could do some stuff and it was good at very little. And today, the rapid transformation you see in that technology sector. Mm. I mean, when the latest interviews I've heard with CEOs all over the place. I mean, Klarna slashed 800 jobs in their customer service and cut down the customer service wait time by half.
Yep.
In the process and save 40 million a year. And they yep. Those are the ones that are talking about it, right? I mean, mm-hmm. IBM with their HR AI that they've just released, those are the ones that are talking because IBM obviously wants to sell their solution. So they are like, yeah, it did great for us. Now here it is for you. This is why they mm-hmm. talk about it. But I think a lot of companies, they don't talk about it.
No, also more difficult to insert that kind of automation and make those kind of economies and savings in capital plant intensive, you know, production based businesses than it is in finance companies or, you know, very human centric, data centric, process driven companies. You could see how AI would absolutely rout workforces in those companies, whereas in the artisanal, you know, actual tangible good space, it's more difficult. Although to your point about AI in CNC, I mean, the strides forward in actual CAD, AI in CAD yeah. have been incredible. AI in nesting software, it's been quite transformational in recent months, actually. And are you adopting some of that then at Allied?
What I'm having and what I'm doing is like because we have Microsoft and Microsoft SharePoint.
My condolences.
I know a lot of people say that, and Phil hates it with a passion as well, and that's all nice and fine. But the world at one point agreed that that's like the data they want to go with. Nevertheless, if you like it or not, I mean, Google is probably gonna go in the same direction. Not that I have played with the Google Suite yet, but Microsoft has something that's called Copilot integrated now, which I think is essentially ChatGPT. Nevertheless, because I have both, so I have ChatGPT private and I have Copilot basically integrated in the whole suite, they work different. They give you different answers. But the big thing about it, and this is like one of the aha moments I had, two weeks ago or something like that. So we had a problem with an assembly that we did. So we had to go down to the customer, see the customer. They took the part apart with us, witnessing. So the whole quality parade, and then everything got taken apart, and we got sent back home and had to write a report basically, and suggest containment actions,
corrective actions,
and so on. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So. When we were back on Monday in the office, I took the sales guy with me, so the two of us sat down, and I wrote a whole 8D report in about an hour, and the longest it took me, the reason why it took that long was because he and me had to dig out some information manually and feed it into Copilot. Because Copilot can find anything that's on our SharePoint, any document, especially because if you are a director, you can see everything. Mm-hmm. So it can find all the documents. So you go in, you put in the name, the reference number, the drawing number, and then you feed everything in, and it's giving you the whole thing. And it did the same for a quality management plan, where you would usually hire classically a consultant for, and you would be probably charged a day rate of at least £500 for it, 1.5 hours. And I've never done it before. I've never written a QMS plan.
Right. But you give it a template, or did it have it inherently?
No.
Right. You just said, I want an 8D, and it...
I said, I want an 8D. This is the product. This is the problem. This is the description. This is what we are thinking about, like as a solution. We can refit the pins. We can do this. We can do that, and then just push go, and then it came up with the solutions. And then you read through it, obviously, and you say, well, that doesn't sound right. All right, let's rephrase that. Take it out into Word. Do like put whatever in and delete whatever is garbage, because it's not like 100% there. feed the Word document back in, say, all right, how about this, and make it like that, and this is the customer name, done.
It's scary, isn't it? I mean, but also it's hugely exciting. I mean, what an empowering moment with just this kind of tech. I mean, you hear, you know, the venture world's getting carried away with this AI powered roll ups. You know, we can go and buy these traditional businesses and we can insert AI and automate the hell out of it and increase the margins and blah, blah, blah. But actually, you know, that's an extrapolation. That's a perfect world unicorn scenario. But what you're living is the real world example of that, where these things that you would normally have had to outsource or lose a day to, or, you know, generally incur cost for, now technology is helping you mitigate for that. And that should be an empowering change. A great time to be buying a business and inserting just simple things like that, I would think.
Yeah, that is like an off-the-shelf solution. There is nobody has programmed anything. Nobody has done anything with it. It's just, it just has all the data that is available in the company. Yeah. And to be honest, like with traditional companies, that's not a lot, but it's still enough data to be able to do something with it.
I mean, in the future, that would just become table stakes. But right now, it's a game changer. It's a differentiator for the companies that are embracing it. Good. So you touched on a little bit there about people. And obviously, you know, you are in an artisanal space with skilled people, something that's often lamented about Western manufacturing sectors is a shortage of skilled labor. How's that playing out in your companies?
I think I know probably at least 60-70% of all the CNC engineers in Greater Manchester. That's how small the pool is. I looked for a very specific skill a couple of months back. In terms of Fusion 360, which is the software that we are using currently.
Yep, the CAD.
As a CAD software. I wanted a FANUC experience because that's the machine language.
Love FANUC.
And at least five axis experience, because we have like 9-axis mill turn machines, like huge things. So you have to know what you're doing.
Multi-tool?
With changers. So it has a turret on the top, and it has the two here and then one on the bottom. So it's like, it can do a lot of things in parallel.
Yeah. It needs to be run by a skilled operator. Yeah.
And I put it on Indeed, and I said, all right, I'll have to sponsor it. Because with headhunters, we've mixed experiences. Some are really good and some are really bad. It's like in every market. So I tried that myself. So I said, all right, sponsor the ad. And when you sponsor the ad in like Indeed, it gives you people that, first of all, it asks you, are those the people that you want? And you classify yes, no, yes, no. So the algorithm learns. Pretty primitive in these days, to be fair. But it works. But it also gives you the possibility to invite people to apply. You're basically giving them a nudge. So they get sent a message mm-hmm. like the recruiter from this company would really like you to look at that ad and apply. And I did that, and I could do, I think, 20 a day. And I would really struggle to find 10 God. That are somewhere close to what I want. Not mm-hmm. like that are a fit, but where I think they are close enough that I can make it work.
Mm.
So at the end, I found the perfect guy, and he applied by himself. So I have no idea how that worked. Divine intervention. He must have been really pissed off where he was before to say like, okay, I really want to change. Boom, do. Because this is also with when people are really skilled and they are fairly treated, they will not.
They'll stay.
And I get it. I mean, people have a mortgage, rent to pay. Kids in school, whatever it is, wherever they are in their life.
And macroeconomically, it's not felt like great conditions to change employment in the last sort of couple of years. In fact, post COVID, you know, other than the Great Resignation, there's been this kind of trepidation of like, you know, ooh, it's not, you know, things aren't smooth. Obviously, cost of living now is driving a lot of people to look, and it's driving lots of employers to have to keep pace with the change in the market. Yeah. But so talent retention, you're finding if you treat them well and you get good people, that's okay. But you know, in terms of trying to grow the business and increase the capacity and make sure you've got, you know, some additional skills there, that it's hard to come by.
It is really hard. It's really hard to find good people, and I think this is also one of the things, because it's not attractive, and it's not like something that you get to know anymore in school or anything.
No.
Or I mean, if you it's like, I mean, I'm over 40, so it's like it's hard to tell what kids do these days, and my son is 8, so he's not in that age anymore. But it's nothing that is popular on social media or any trends or anything to get your hands greasy and work with machines or weld stuff together or bend it into shape or laser cut it. It's not well promoted.
Yeah, it's not well promoted as a career choice.
Well, and definitely home office is not on the table.
No, exactly. So, that's an interesting kind of caveat for any searcher that's looking to acquire in the engineering spaces. There is almost a global talent shortage, certainly in the Western developed worlds, of skilled artisans, that you know, even at machine operator level for these kinds of businesses. So it can be a bit of a growth inhibitor. And some of the companies that I've looked at and worked with acquisition entrepreneurs looking at, where they've actually taken skills development in-house with their own academies, or they're working with colleges on apprenticeship programs, that they're sorting some of their talent pipeline out. But it's sowing seeds for the very long term rather than having an immediate solution. So let's teleport back to 2020, and you're in New York. You're having this meeting with Phil. He's talking you into the idea of coming to the UK and doing some acquisitions and operating some engineering companies. If 2025 Jan-Marc was to materialize in the middle of that conversation with some advice, what would you hope that advice might be, knowing what you know now?
That is a real good question. If we want to do this, and if we want to buy the companies, we'll have to take a break, and we have to be very selective on when we are taking on the next deal, in terms of. Because you are debt loaded, if you finance it with debt, which you have to serve, so that has to come from somewhere, and to be more pushy that soon as we have the two companies, that directors have to work in the business. Right in the beginning, to be not like a financial burden to the business, on the one hand, but also to have a chance to learn the business. Because I think the best thing that happened, and it sounds really tragic, because our MD at the time he got really sick, so he couldn't continue to work, which is unfortunate. But for me, that was the best thing, because I had to go into the CNC business at that time. That was EGL1 and located in Glossop, and had to run it. Have you ever done
CNC machining before?
No. I've done it at university. I knew how it looked like. I know how they work. I know metals, roughly. I mean, I couldn't program a CNC machine if my life depended on it. I probably can learn it, especially nowadays with like YouTube videos, and you can learn G-code. If you really want it, you can probably learn it. But it was the best thing, because it gave me it. I had to be really on the ground, and I was in the fabrication businesses at that time on the ground. And I had to learn how to quote. I had to learn how to plan the shop floor, and all the certification and implementing the MRP properly. Because MRPs are great if they are implemented properly. If they are half-assed, for better words, they are wrecking your business, because nothing lines up anymore, and then people start cheating the system, and then you have like a stock of 400k, which you don't really have, just because they don't know how to ship stuff properly and things like that. And I think that would have been my advice, is that there is like a mandatory half year or year for every director to work different jobs in the business to really, really understand how it's going on, and how does this, and how it's done. And I can only give that advice to anybody that acquires a business. It's not rocket science, and you can learn it. Mm-hmm. But you have to be willing to commit to that type of thing, because you see where you lose the money. You see if people, if you have that culture where people are trying to hide stuff. And one thing I said is like, I made clear really quickly, I started, because you have those metal scrap bins where like all the swarf chips mm-hmm. fall into, and they usually would also throw in the either the setting pieces or the pieces that just got wrong when they were basically done. So that there was like a clear communication, as like, and I was going through the swarf bins every other day basically, and put and took parts out and put them on the canteen table.
Mm-hmm.
every time, until no parts ended up in there, and we had a discussion about why the hell that went wrong. Why did we break the tap? I don't care that they broke a tap. Yes, it's not ideal, but you want to learn. I mean, it's like, and the only way you learn is discussing why the hell did we do it this way?
Yeah.
Was that the best way we could have done it? Is there a different way? And can we change something to not always break a tap?
You only see these things when you actually immerse yourself in the shop floor, in the operation, in where the work is done, put yourself in a position where you can have those conversations with the staff and drive that kind of continuous improvement mindset from within, rather than from above, where you normally end up meeting resistance. Right? If it's you by mandate, it's much more different than if it's us collectively trying to solve a problem.
It's day and night. That is day and night. But you get a different respect if you try to really understand what the difficulty is. At one point, I mean, as like we still have one brilliant operator, but I think it took me 3 months until he would start talking to me. Just because he's introverted. It's not because he's a bad person, but it's like your typical introverted, very competent engineer, and not really trusting. So it took a long time for him to open up, but there came some really, really good things out of it, in terms of changing fixtures to make the jobs faster, using different feeds, speeds, using different tools. I threw away a lot of the HSS tools, and I'm like, why are we using them? It's like, well, we've always done it, and they are cheaper. And I'm like, yeah, but they are cheaper than a carbide, but you can run a carbide, and you just told me that you run a carbide and it's done in 5 minutes, and with the HSS you do it in 10, and then you have to send them for regrinding, and you need 5 of them. It doesn't make any sense.
False economy.
And I get it from the operator perspective, because if they are told make do with what you have, they will make do with what you have. But they will all, if they get told you can't spend any money, then they will avoid spending any money, and they will not tell you that if you spend £50, we'll make 200.
Yeah, but I mean, that mindset doesn't necessarily ever really permeate down to the shop floor, like that return on investment mindset. You have to really cultivate that and give permission, as we talked about earlier. So. Yeah, really interesting, fascinating insights. And I'm sure listeners are taking quite a lot of learnings from this, you know, if they want to get involved in owning, you know, complex engineering businesses, you know, they should proceed with caution and take the sort of approach that you've taken to get stuck in at the coalface, so to speak. So let's fast forward 12 months. You mentioned to me that you've got quite a lot on at the moment. You've got some exciting things unfolding in a good way. So if we look in 12 months, we check in. Where do you hope that you are with these businesses and more?
Well, it's like there are a few changes definitely coming up, and where I hope to be in 12 months is I definitely want to drive technology just to be as efficient as possible. I think this is like because if you think about it, if you run a company that has a robot, the robot doesn't care where it stands in the world. It gets paid the same, nothing. And it consumes electricity that might be a bit more expensive. So if you want to compete, you have to opt for some automation. I want to make an impact. If you want to build a successful business, you only do that if you stay relevant.
Very true. To your business, to your colleagues, and to your customers, 100%.
Exactly.
That has been hugely insightful, Mark. Thank you so much. Is there any message you'd like to impart to our listeners and viewers? Anything that you'd like to ensure that they take away from this by way of advice or ways to contact you or anything that you might ask from them?
No, I mean, you can find me on LinkedIn. LinkedIn is my preferred medium, to be honest. I do have Instagram as well and Facebook and so on, but LinkedIn is the best way to reach me. I'm definitely changing a bit the approach and the model. So in terms of a management buy-in, so if you know anybody that wants to get out of their business, I'm happy to have a look at it. I'm also happy to help making a business more presentable to a buyer because I've been on the other side. I know what we look at and I know what we value, and I really also know what we don't value. So that's the thing, but thanks for having me, and I hope that everybody that, and thanks for listening and watching, and I hope that you get something out of it, that one little thing will. That makes it better.
It's lovely to go from the sort of tactical to the practical, if you will, and actually hear from people that are living this post acquisition reality of the sort of warts and all of running these businesses, and glad that you're enjoying the ride, Jan-Marc.
Mostly, yeah, mostly. To stay honest,
he said.
It's mostly enjoyable.
Yeah, great. Well, thanks again, and thanks everybody for listening. We've got more interviews coming up for you over the weeks ahead, but until then, keep on crunching. Bye for now.
Thank you, bye.